All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Margaret Bartley presiding. All who have business before this court, draw near and you will be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome. I'm Judge Bartley, and I'm joined today by Judge Falvey and Judge Lara. Before we begin the argument, I want to note that the court is sitting today in the Francis M. Leetro courtroom at the University at Buffalo School of Law in Buffalo, New York. The court thanks the law school for welcoming us. It's been a wonderful welcome. And special thanks especially to Interim Dean Brown, Professor Kim Diana Connolly, and also to Benjamin Pomerantz of the New York State Department of Veterans Services. We're here today for the matter of Herbert N. Haskell II versus Dennis McDonough, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, docket number 22-1018. Unfortunately, yesterday the court was notified that just yesterday Mr. Haskell passed away while receiving hospice care. There has been a motion to substitute filed. The court extends sincere sympathy to the veterans' survivors, and we will proceed with argument. Counsel for the parties, please state your name and your appearance for the record, beginning with appellant's counsel.
Thank you, Chief Judge Bartley. Amy Odom from the law firm of Chisholm, Chisholm & Kilpatrick, and with me at counsel table is April Donahauer, also from the law firm of Chisholm, Chisholm & Kilpatrick.
Thank you, Ms. Odom and Ms. Donahauer. Welcome.
Thank you, Chief Judge. Brian Carey for the Secretary and with Ronnie Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Carey and Mr. Morris. Each party, as you know, will have 30 minutes to present argument. Ms. Odom, how much time would you like to reserve?
We'd like to reserve 10 minutes, Your Honor.
Okay, we will make that happen, and you may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Chief Judge Bartley, and may it please the Court. The text, structure, and history of 1114 subsection T all compel one conclusion. A showing of a need for a higher level of care, as that term is defined in subsection R2 and 38 CFR 3.352B, is not a prerequisite to an award of enhanced special monthly compensation based on residuals of TBI. It is a fundamental principle of statutory interpretation that when Congress omits a word or phrase that appears elsewhere in the statute, it does so on purpose. Here in 2010, when Congress added subsection T, it did not include the term higher level of care. Clearly, then, Congress intended to create different substantive requirements for enhanced special monthly compensation based on residuals of TBI. Congress's intent is clear not only from the text and structure of 1114, but also from the history of subsection T. Congress was well aware in 2010 that higher level of care meant the kinds of services that aren't necessarily needed for veterans suffering from severe psychiatric and cognitive residuals of TBI, such as supervision for safety, and assistance with activities of a higher level. Therefore, we ask this court to set aside the regulatory requirement of a showing for a higher level of care, vacate the board's decision, and remand for the board to apply 1114T as written by Congress. As mentioned, one need not pore over the legislative history of subsection T to ascertain what is clear from the text itself. A higher level of care is not needed for an award of enhanced special monthly compensation under subsection T. There is a presumption not only that when Congress doesn't use a phrase that is found elsewhere in the statute, but when it uses a phrase that is found elsewhere in the statute, it does so on purpose. And here in subsection T, Congress used only the words regular aid in attendance. It did not use the words higher level of care. And though regular aid in attendance is mentioned also in subsection R2, it is but one requirement for an enhanced level of special monthly compensation under R2. Higher level of care is an additional requirement, and it's that additional requirement that Congress omitted from subsection T. Furthermore, Congress made clear that it was expressly targeting those veterans who did not qualify for compensation under R2 when it added T. And one of the requirements of R2 that's not in T is the higher level of care. And when it added subsection T in 2010, it did not expand the statutory definition of higher level of care to include subsection T. It left the words, which had been there since 1978, for the purposes of subsection R2, higher level of care means.
Ms. Odom, would you address the Secretary's argument about reading the statute as a whole? Because your interpretation and your view seems to focus on the T section and the R2 section, but they tried to put it in context of what, trying to make the all of the parts of the statute consistent.
Our reading does make all of those parts of the statute consistent. Regular aid in attendance means exactly what it means in L, and that's been defined by 3.352A, a definition that had been around for decades when Congress created subsection T and used those same words that you find in L, regular aid in attendance. Also, as I mentioned, the definition of higher level of care that Congress created is limited to R2. There's nothing extending it to subsection T. The Secretary's reading of subsection T, or as the regulator statute as a whole, seeks to create ambiguity where there is none. According to the Secretary in the pleadings proffered to this court, it's the requirement that a veteran otherwise need institutionalization, which somehow creates some ambiguity, which is only found in subsection T. It's not reading the statute as a whole. But there is no ambiguity. The presumption that Congress purposely omitted the language of higher level of care doesn't create ambiguity. It's the Secretary's obligation to rebut that presumption with something, and they have not. They are trying to use the presumption as itself creating the ambiguity. And furthermore, the ambiguity that the Secretary discusses in the brief, or the rationale for why there's an ambiguity, is different than the rationale that the Secretary provided in the Federal Register in 2010 or 2011, implementing subsection T. According to the Secretary in the Federal Register, the reason why the statute is ambiguous, or subsection T is ambiguous, is because Congress intended to pay the same rate to veterans who qualify under subsection T as they did to veterans who qualify under subsection R2. That's a different rationale than what they've offered here in the brief, which is that the need for the counterfactual of the need for the institutionalization is what creates the ambiguity. But in fact, in reading the statute as a whole, there is no ambiguity. Congress was very clear. Higher level of care is not a prerequisite to an award of special monthly compensation based on residuals of TBI. It's also borne out by the legislative history, in particular the Senate report that we cited. In the Senate report, Congress discussed how veterans who suffer from severe residuals of TBI don't need the kind of health care services, perhaps, that a veteran with severe anatomical or physical injuries need, and those veterans who would qualify under R2 for the higher level of care. So it makes no sense, then, knowing that Congress is presumed to have understood in 2010 that the 30-year-old definition of higher level of care, which contemplates services that require health care training, would not be something that a veteran with severe cognitive and psychological residuals of TBI would require. So we would ask the court to find that the statute is clear on its face, there is no ambiguity, and under Chevron step one, find that Congress spoke when it said that the only requirements for an award of special monthly compensation under subsection T are that the veteran be in need of regular aid and attendance, as defined under 3.352A, as a result of TBI, and without that aid and attendance would otherwise need residential institutionalization.
So when you say stop at Chevron step one, so the statute, there's no ambiguity in the statute, we need go no further.
Yes, Your Honor.
So we don't need to get to Chevron step two. Is this a permissible interpretation? Is permissible gap filling?
There is no gap. Congress laid clear what are the requirements for subsection T, special monthly compensation. Regular aid in attendance as a result of TBI that would otherwise put the veteran in a situation of needing institutionalization.
So your reading of SMCT is that if the veteran is in need of regular aid in attendance because of TBI, traumatic brain injury, if the answer to that is yes, the second question is, without that regular aid and attendance, would they need to be institutionalized? If that answer to that is yes, they qualify.
That's right.
And that's all from the plain language of T, no gap in that analysis, right?
Exactly.
And so anything that adds to that by regulation unnecessarily adds to that should be invalidated.
That's right, exactly.
Ms. Zoda?
Yes, Your Honor.
As you know, the Secretary has conceded error based on the TBI evaluation that was done, and argues that the court should remand, which would be a very narrow basis of remand for reasons or bases under that theory. In the appellant's reply brief, you addressed the issue of why, in your opinion, that would not result in relief for the appellant. Can you expand upon why the court should not remand, as the Secretary suggests in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, the proposed remand is completely irrelevant to the reason why the board denied the claim. The board denied the claim because it found that the service or the assistance that the veteran needs as a result or needed as a result of his TBI were not the kind of services that required health care training. And that is in the regulatory definition of health or higher level of care. There are things like placement of indwelling catheter, wound care, physical therapy, things that veterans like Mr. Haskell, who suffered from severe cognitive impairment, wouldn't need. You don't need health care training to supervise a veteran for his own safety. You don't need health care training to help a veteran with activities of a higher level involving planning and organization. So if the court were to remand on the basis that the Secretary proposed in his brief, we would just be back here in a year from now or whatnot when we get another denial, because the board is bound by 3.352B little 2. And 3.352B little 2 says you must show a need for a higher level of care as defined in this regulation in order to be entitled to the enhanced special monthly compensation under 1114T. And it's that requirement that is inconsistent with the statute and should be set aside.
And in this case, the appellant is focused on the requirement that follows with respect to residential institution. Do you see that as an equivalent, without using the term, obviously, in the statute of a higher level of care? Do you see that as a somewhat of an equivalent in the case of a TBI where you don't have the same physical manifestations that you would have with a traumatic brain injury?
Your Honor, I'm not sure if I understand the question, so forgive me, but are you asking whether the need for a higher level of care is the equivalent to assistance that would otherwise render the veteran in need of hospitalization?
Just with respect to SMCT in this case, you see that as satisfying, again, without using the follow-on definition under SMCR, for example, of what the definition of higher level of care, you would see that condition, and you specifically mentioned in the briefing that in this case what's relevant would be the residential care. Again, not suggesting that it would need to meet the definition, but obviously this would be a case where in addition to the other requirements of aid in attendance, TBI, you would also include in that the burden for the appellant to prove that in this case the relevant factor would be the residential care.
Yes, the veteran, it is the burden is on the claimant to show that without the regular aid in attendance, the veteran would need hospitalization or institutionalization. And in this case, we have a medical opinion that without the regular aid and attendance provided by the veteran's wife, he would have needed institutionalization. He needs an alert system for falls. He gets lost in the mall or going outside in an unfamiliar area. He can't use GPS. He relies on his wife for everything. But Mr. Haskell's wife having to ensure that he doesn't get lost, that somebody is there if he fell, and otherwise protect him from his own environment is not something that needs healthcare training. And therefore, this requirement in the regulation that a veteran show that the level of assistance needed is such that the person providing it would need health care training is inconsistent with the statute.
But the statute doesn't just say supervised care or something like that. It says hospitalization or nursing home care or other, implying that it's like hospitalization or nursing home care, other residential institutional care. Can't that be read to imply that there's something more that's required, and then the Secretary's counsel may very well argue that that something more is that what's being provided at home is the equivalent of that?
No, Your Honor. Congress knew how to say higher level of care is required also, and Congress did not do that, and we can't ignore that. That is presumed to be a deliberate choice, and it's borne out by the legislative history. Again, I go back to the Senate report. There was testimony from the wife of a veteran who suffered a severe TBI at OIF and said there are medical and non-medical services that these veterans need to stay in their homes and their communities.
But why the phraseology, though? Hospitalization, nursing home care, or other residential care facility?
Well, there surely are assisted living facilities that don't, focus on medical treatment, that are just there to ensure that their residents are their safety, and that they're able to be supervised, because otherwise the person would be in a danger to himself or others. And so that's what Congress must have intended, because if they intended that they have to be health care services that are provided in these facilities, Congress knew how to say that. It did it in the 70s, and it didn't do it in the 2010.
And I think this is kind of a softball to you, but in R2, where it does talk about higher level of care, in T it says you have to be ineligible under R2. But if we read, tell me if I'm wrong here, but if we read the higher level of care into T, aren't we making T and R2 basically saying the same thing?
Yes, Your Honor. You're requiring where...
And how can you be ineligible for R2 if they're the equivalent?
Well, candidly, you can be ineligible for R2 if you don't reach the MOP levels of special monthly compensation.
What's that?
For under 1114M, I believe it's things like loss of use of both hands, loss of use of both feet, an arm and a hand. And then once you get higher, there are different steps. And Congress recognized in the Senate report that, and the Secretary recognized in the Federal Register, that generally veterans who suffer from severe cognitive and physical or psychological disabilities as a result of TBI aren't going to meet that prerequisite. But they also acknowledged, at least Congress did, that those veterans who suffer from these severe residuals also don't need the types of care that veterans who would otherwise qualify under OM&P based on their physical injuries would. But Congress wanted veterans to be able to access the types of care that they needed for their TBI residuals, and that's why they created subsection T, not as an equivalent to R2, but as a more straightforward way for veterans who suffer from these, they have to be severe residuals to get the level of compensation that is provided to veterans with physical injuries.
And if they wanted just to make it an equivalent, to just include it within R2 as the equivalent of loss of arms, limbs,
right,
et cetera. Instead,
right,
they created a different provision with different requirements.
That's right. I mean, I'm old enough to remember in 2009 there was a national awakening to traumatic brain injury as the signature wound of veterans coming home from OIF, OEF. And this is Congress's attempt to ensure that those veterans receive the care that they need when they returned.
So, but again, going back to my earlier question, just to sort of tie this up.
Don, please add five minutes.
The appellant has a favorable ruling from the board, which is a requirement for regular aid and attendance. But in this case, based on SMCT, there's also almost like a but-for. But-for that regular aid in attendance, the claimant here would require either hospitalization, nursing home care, or residential institutional care. So if this were to be remanded, the board would need to make a finding with respect to that aspect,
yes,
of the requirements under SMCT.
Yes, Your Honor. The board did not reach that question in the decision below because it cut off the analysis on whether the types of assistance that Mr. Haskell needed required health care training, and that's simply not a requirement under the statute.
And that ties back into your other argument with respect to what the Secretary has suggested here, an R&B reason or basis remand would not make a difference because the board would be bound by what they see as a requirement for higher level of care, similar to what's required under the subsection R.
Yes, and they would. It's not just what they saw as a requirement for higher level care. It's in the books. It's in the federal or the Code of Federal Regulations to under which they're bound in 7104C.
Thank you.
And if there are no other questions, we ask the court to set aside Section 3.352B2(2) to the extent that it requires a showing of a need for a higher level of care for an award of enhanced special monthly compensation under 1114T. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Odom. Mr. Carey, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. And if I may just initially share our condolences to the family of Mr. Haskell and express our gratitude for his service and his sacrifices. Now to the issue at hand. In order to determine whether the provisions of Section T are genuinely ambiguous, we need to first determine what the precise question at issue is, and then to determine whether Congress spoke directly to that question. Now here, the precise question is whether veterans with severe traumatic brain injury with a need for regular aid and attendance, and all, without which they would require hospitalization or institutional care, should be entitled to additional compensation based on that need, whereas veterans with severe physical disabilities, such as the loss of multiple limbs and total blindness, would not similarly be entitled to such compensation. Now, for the following reasons, Congress did not speak directly to that precise question. First, this statute refers specifically to eligibility and not entitlement. And eligibility was the specific issue that Congress was addressing in legislating this issue. Second, to create such a disparity in entitlement for similar levels of disability would be inconsistent with the overall purpose of the system of disability compensation, which is to award compensation based on the level of disability. And third, in drawing reasonable inferences from the statutory text, there are some inherent inconsistencies and ambiguities, again, within that text. So overall, we must view specific language in the statute in the context of other language, of the overall context of the statute and the legislative history. So we cannot really read certain passages in isolation here. So going to the first topic of the eligibility was the problem that Congress was attempting to address. And that's why that they deliberately used that term in the statute as opposed to entitlement. And if I may expand a little bit on the background of why it was the question or the problem that Congress was addressing. So in both in our argument here and in the reply brief, appellant accurately cites the statistics that VA provided to Congress in showing that for veterans with traumatic brain injury and the need for aid and attendance, not at the time, the 165 veterans, none of them would qualify under Section R2, which has the requirements for a higher level of care. Well, that's accurate, but it's incomplete because none of the veterans also qualified under R1. And the way the statute operates is that if a veteran is entitled under Section R by virtue of entitlement to by having traumatic brain injury with a need for aid and assistance, and then the other physical disability requirement, that aid and attendance serves as the requirement under Section R1. So in simpler terms, in those circumstances, eligibility equals entitlement. So the fact that none of the veterans also qualified under R1 means that entitlement was the problem. They never got to the requirements under R2, and which applies the standards for a higher level of care. So that is also the exactly as the Secretary presented the problem to Congress, and I believe as Congress understood it, referring to the purpose of the bill is to allow veterans with severe traumatic brain injury to the highest levels of compensation. And I disagree with opposing counsel in that the legislative history clearly showed a different interest or a different problem. The legislative history refers to, again, the general focus on physical disabilities, and that's true because the eligibility requires a physical disability, and most of the sections in 1114 refer to physical disabilities. However, the one section that does not is Section R. It makes no distinctions between physical or cognitive disabilities. And so that those references within the legislative history are reasonably understood as referring to eligibility because that was the problem. And so when we look then at the plain language of the statute, which refers to eligibility, it's very clear what Congress's intent was. It was to solve that problem and not to then create a different problem or a different inequity in ensuring that veterans with traumatic brain injury were equally eligible as veterans with severe physical disabilities for benefits, and to then create a different standard for entitlement to such benefits by here being not having to meet the requirements under R2 for a higher level of care. So that is the first context in which we need to read the other plain language of the statute, which we concede is, you know, when read literally means, and we presume that Congress meant what it wrote, would mean only that a veteran requires aid and assistance, regular aid and assistance, and absent that would require hospitalization or other institutional care. But again, that is the first context which suggests that that meaning is ambiguous. So the second important context is that, and I believe Chief Judge Bartley, you kind of alluded to this, is that this would be inconsistent with the overall operation of the system of disability benefits and the overall purpose of the statute in general to provide benefits commensurate with the level of disability. And that's very clear within Section 1114T itself, where, again, mostly referring to physical disabilities, but you can see the increased level of compensation corresponding to the increased severity of the disability, such as additional loss of limbs or the levels of blindness increasing. It's also consistent with the authority that Congress gave to the Secretary to develop a rating system based on the impact on, you know, economic capability or productivity. So, again, the whole system is about ensuring that veterans with the same level of disability receive the same level of compensation. And here, if we are to take the language of Section T literally, it would mean that veterans with traumatic brain injury only need to show that but for the regular aid and attendance, they would require hospitalization, whereas veterans with severe physical disabilities would have an intermediate step in order to show that.
But so. You lost me there, because what you said is just what the statute says. You said that would mean that veterans with TBI would only have to show that they needed aid in attendance, and that without it, regular aid in attendance, and that without it, they would need institutionalization. And then you said, that can't be the case, but let's just talk about the plain language of the statute. Isn't that what the statute says?
Yes, sure.
You sound like you're calling into question Congress's judgment on the matter.
I'm not calling into question Congress's judgment, Your Honor, because it's demonstrating an inconsistency in policy between veterans with traumatic brain injury and veterans with severe physical disabilities for whom the level of disability would be the same. And again, in Section T, it would have requirements for that are literally, we read the literal language, the requirements for veterans with traumatic brain injury. Under Section R, through which veterans with severe physical disabilities could be entitled to that same rate under Section R2, they have to meet an additional step. And so, again, it creates a disparity in the requirements for entitlement to the same rate for veterans with the same level, albeit maybe in difference in nature to a certain extent, the same overall level of disability. And if I could briefly on that respond to the opposing counsel's characterization of the legislative history as showing...
Before you do,
is
what you're saying is that Congress could not have intended such an absurd result? Is that...
I wouldn't characterize it as absurd. Congress certainly could do that. I believe it's against current policy that Congress has implemented overall with the system of benefits, and that it would be inconsistent with that. Is it? I wouldn't call that absurd, Your Honor.
Well, as we're doing, you know, statutory interpretation, it's we should rely on traditional canons of statutory interpretation, and one of them is that you shouldn't interpret a statute so as to present absurd results. So that's one side of the coin, but it seems that the other side of the coin is that if Congress wrote something absurd, is it our job to rewrite it for them?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I think that the issue is whether or not, even though there is particular language here that read in isolation could mean something, that we still have to read that in the context, again, of the other language in the statute, such as, or in this provision, as a matter of fact, including eligibility, which was the problem that Congress was attempting to solve, as well as in the overall context of the broader statute, again, in this case, being the same level of disability entitles veterans to the same level of compensation, to include here the specific reference in Section T to Section R, the rate in Section R2, indicating Congress's intention to ensure that these veterans receive the same level of compensation.
Right. And I get that, you know, that someone who's getting eligibility under R2 then has a higher burden of showing that they're in need of higher level of care. But if you look at the language of it, another canon of its statutory interpretation, Congress uses language in one place and they don't use it in another place. That means something. We presume Congress knew what they were doing when they decided or excluded certain language, and they excluded it from T. It doesn't say higher level of care. And now you'd like us to read that into it. Those are kind of high hurdles when the language is pretty straightforward.
Yes, Your Honor, it is the presumption, and it is a high hurdle. But the Secretary's argument is that the issues we're presenting today and that we have in our brief meet that high hurdle and let us and overcome that. As we're discussing absurd results, there is a potential for absurd results in the literal meaning or the literal reading of Section T, which does not contemplate, if we're reading Section T strictly, and as appellant argues, we need to and we should read the terms consistently across provisions, and that Congress deliberately distinguished the meanings of provisions, Section T does not contemplate the higher level of care. So in a circumstance where a veteran who is in need of regulated attendance that is no longer sufficient and then needs a higher level of care in order to take care of those functions in life, if we're to read the language strictly and consider all of the definitions consistent across provisions and within the statute as a whole, then that veteran who needs a high level of care will not be eligible under Section T. Now, that is an absurd result, and we don't think that the Secretary doesn't believe that Congress intended that, but again, if we're reading language strictly and interpreting terms, using the meanings of terms consistently across provisions, then that would be the result. Now, we can reasonably, again, recognize that that's absurd and fill in some gaps or use some inferences to reason that, well, not there, that doesn't mean that the regular aid and attendance incorporates the concept of a higher level of care in that situation. But now we're into the reasonable inferences and filling in the gaps, which itself demonstrates an ambiguity. And if I may, there's another inherent, I think, inconsistency or ambiguity within the language of Section T. And that is, it is unclear how the relationship between regular aid and attendance and the need for hospitalization, a nursing home care, or other institutional care is materially different than that already implied in the term for regular aid and attendance. Because at its root, those are about health care. They're health-related issues, because you would need hospitalization or nursing home care, institutional care. That's consistent with the Secretary's definition in the regulations, which refers to, and I'll use plain language, the ability of a veteran to feed himself or to go to the bathroom on his own or to bathe and to avoid the daily hazards or the hazards of daily life as a result of both cognitive and physical disabilities. And so when we consider just the meaning of regular aid and attendance in itself, we don't just stop at, well, they need regular aid and attendance, and then what happens? We have to contemplate, well, what does that mean after that? Absent that regular aid and attendance, something happens, and the reasonable inference is that the veteran would need some type of care to fill in. And ultimately, that would be hospitalization, nursing home care, or institutional care. So that is implicit in the concept of regular aid and attendance. And then what that would imply is that Section T is, again, not materially different, and that Congress would be compensating a veteran for the same regular aid and attendance that they were already compensated for under Section L.
Mr. Carey, you lost me earlier whenever you said you were talking about the potential absurd result here, and you said, so that would mean that a veteran with TBI under T would not be allowed to get the rate of payment that's made under R2?
Yes, Your Honor. So the rate of payment under R2 and T is the same, right? So,
yeah.
But looking under T, because T, again, if we're reading it strictly, T does not contemplate the higher level of care, kind of intermediate step.
Yeah, but it says, I still don't understand what you're saying. It says that if you need regular aid and attendance due to a TBI, you're not eligible under R2. You get paid at R2. So I don't understand the absurdity.
I apologize, Your Honor. I'll try to clarify. Because Section T does not contemplate a higher level of care, right? Is that clear?
Yes, that's what Congress,
right.
left out.
Right. It doesn't refer
assuming,
to that.
I assume that was intentional.
Right. So we're assuming that. That's what we're assuming. That was intentional, it was deliberate, and it does not contemplate that. Well, a higher level of care has a specific definition under R. So if as a practical matter...
Can you just clarify R1 or R2?
Sorry, R2. Higher level of care under R2. Thank you, Your Honor. So, and that's specifically defined, and we assume that Congress has, again, defined terms deliberately. So in a factual circumstance of a veteran who is in need of regular aid and attendance, which, again, becomes no longer sufficient, and they essentially advance to a higher level of care, getting, medical care at home to take care of those same needs, then that no longer meets the definition under Section T. That's the absurd result. They are no longer in need of regular aid and attendance. They are in need of a higher level of care. That's what they're receiving, according to the definitions within the statute. Again, it's an absurd result. But if we're strictly reading the language of the statute, that is a possible result, which requires, again, some inferences or some gap filling in order to overcome.
Your argument doesn't
okay.
make any sense to me, but I appreciate you explaining it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Carey, I want to go back to a question that I asked appellant's counsel, and that is, in this case, the appellant has a favorable finding, right, that he is in need of regular aid and attendance. The board also found that the type of support that his spouse is providing does not amount to higher level care. And so, although the Secretary is conceding that there was board error here, his suggestion, which normally the court would follow, right, the narrowest type of remand, which would be a reasons or bases, can you explain to me how that would make a difference when you have a board that is going to go back and look at the same regulation and has already determined that the type of care that Mrs. Haskell is providing does not amount to higher level of care?
So we disagree with, in an odd circumstance, I suppose, Your Honor, we disagree with appellant that it would, a remand on that basis would serve no purpose. We do see inadequacies in the board, as we briefed, inadequacies in the board addressing the probative value of the 2017 private medical opinion and the as compared to the 2001 VA medical opinion, as well as the probative value of the Mr. Haskell's wife's affidavit describing many of describing her level, her participation in that. And so we stand by that reading and that would be appropriate. However, again, if appellant has conceded that point, then should the court accept that concession, then it would be appropriate to affirm the decision. But we have not changed our position, and again, we feel that there were some inadequacies in the court's rationale there.
So walk me through it, please, if you would. How could a remand under these circumstances, what findings would the board possibly make based on the regulation that would say, hey, higher level of care defines what that is? And I realize this is in theory, but, you know, walk me through. How would that work? How would this potentially provide a benefit? I mean, what would be the purpose of a remand for reasons or bases under these circumstances?
Certainly, Your Honor. So, for example, the 2017 private medical opinion indicated a need for institutional care by, I think, a neurologist and internist, and also indicated the need for supervised administration of chronic medication. Mr. Haskell's wife's statements referred to the use of or the administration of medications, you know, under the direction of the doctor. So there is room for a factual finding that Mr. Haskell required a higher level of care, again, depending on the probative value that the board placed on that evidence as well as its reliance on the 2021 VA medical opinion, which indicated that Mr. Haskell did not require a higher level of care. So the evidence is there to make the finding, and again, it relied on the board's the findings on the probative value of that evidence. So there is room for the board to reconsider and find that Mr. Haskell required a higher level of care under the current regulation. Are there any further questions?
Mr. Carey, I do want to go back to the absurd result that you... So is your argument that the interpretation that appellant is putting forth would be absurd because the veteran would not be entitled to payment an R2 amount of payment because all that subsection T requires is service-connected TBI in need for, and due to that, the veteran needs regular aid and attendance. Is that...
And without which the veteran would require hospitalization, right? Jumps right from regular aid and attendance to the need for hospitalization. Uh-huh. So there's no intermediate step contemplated in section T as there is in section R. Uh-huh. So if indeed what their need is that intermediate step, which T does not contemplate, then by the very definitions in the statutes and the distinction between terms and the strict language, then the veteran would no longer be in need of regular aid and attendance. They would be in need of a higher level of care.
Well, they would meet the requirements of T, which provide that if you meet the requirements of T, you get paid at the R2 rate.
I think that's the question. Do they meet the requirements of T in that reading of the statute and in comparing the terms? That if it doesn't contemplate a higher level of care, and that's actually what the veteran requires, not just regular aid and attendance, right? I understand.
Okay, so
your
absurd result requires that we adopt your interpretation of the statute?
No, Your Honor. The absurd result results in appellant's interpretation, which is based on, again, the strict language of the text. I apologize for not explaining it.
Could you try one more time?
I see two categories here.
Right.
You have the language of T, which is you have a TBI, service connected. Due to that TBI, you need regular aid and attendance, and without which you would need the institutionalized care. And if those requirements are met, you get paid at the R2 rate. Your point of view is, but has to do with R2, the current requirement of R2. And what you're saying is, yes, but this individual under T has not met the R2 requirements and therefore can't be paid under R2. But, in fact, the TBI statute allows the veteran to be paid at the R2 rate with just the simple requirements that not so simple, actually, but the requirements that I mentioned.
So may I use an example, Your Honor,
sure.
from the facts, going back to the suggestion that Mr. Haskell required supervised administration of medication. So in that example, if a veteran requires aid and attendance for the administration of medication, an example, taking pills, remembering to take pills, that's regular aid and attendance. If that then advances to a supervised administration of medication, and maybe that is, in certain cases, injections instead of pill format, or that it requires, that administration requires monitoring the veteran every day to determine the level of medication, and that's under the supervision of a medical professional, that's now meets the definition of a higher level of care, which Section T doesn't contemplate. So the veteran no longer needs regular aid and attendance. They need a higher level of care in that example. So I hope that was somewhat illustrative of the concept.
And that's because the subsection T dispenses with the requirement for a higher level of care.
Yes, Your Honor. It does not contemplate it anymore. So
it dispensed with it. So
it dispensed
that
with it, yes.
If you are under T, you don't need to prove a higher level of care.
That is, I think, one way to look at it. It also, again, if we're looking again the strict text, that it omitted that it does not, it's not that it didn't require it. So the issue here is not that even if it does not require it, if the veteran is receiving it and is actually, as defined in the statute, is receiving a higher level of care and no longer needs regular aid and assistance, then Section T does not contemplate that scenario, and that a veteran would be denied entitlement under Section T, whereas they would be granted entitlement under Section R. And that's the absurd result. And I think, again, I provided the example of where that could happen with the change in the needs for the administration of medication from regular aid and attendance to a higher level of care.
I'm reminded here of something Judge Sholin, her wise advice when I became a judge, and that is, don't argue with counsel because you're the one who decides the case. I'm not sure I understand, but that might be my fault, not yours. And I appreciate your going into the detail of explaining it.
I don't know that you can answer this, but I'm going to ask the question anyway. If Congress had intended a requirement under SMCT to include higher level of care, they clearly know how to do that. Why wouldn't they have included it in the statute? SMCR already existed until this addition was made to allow for traumatic brain injury. Why wouldn't Congress, if that was a requirement, have included that in the actual statute rather than not including it, which you're arguing is opening the door for the secretary to implement through a regulation that does require it, that does require higher level of care.
My time is about to expire. May I briefly answer your question?
Please.
Yes, let's add 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. So I would look to the legislative history and, in particular, the 2009 Senate report where, Congress kind of goes from more detailed levels of description to less details of the description of the operation of the statutes in cutting out some language and leaving in some other language, and then ultimately getting to the draft in that report, the draft a language of the statute, which leaps from regular aid and attendance to a higher level of care. So given the other issues that I've raised that we believe indicate an ambiguity in that language, it appears that Congress may have just used an abridged or shorthand version of the requirements under Section R and to incorporate economically under Section T. And that didn't maybe work out as Congress intended as we're here today.
But couldn't that just as easily cut the other way when you look at the Senate report that talks about the difference between traumatic brain injury and the type of injuries under subsection R being the difference between, physical and particularly when you look at the definition of higher level of care, which are all physical types of things, couldn't that just as easily cut the other way, at least with respect to the Senate report?
So, of course, thank you. There are two questions there, Your Honor. So, of course, the use of legislative history has been criticized by many judges and justices. I think it is instructive here. But we disagree with opposing counsel that the legislative history clearly shows a material distinction between the overall disabling effects or levels of traumatic brain injury and severe physical disabilities. And, again, there are a lot of use of general terms. In the end of the conclusion of the Senate report refers to ensuring that veterans can receive the care to live as normal lives possible. I'm paraphrasing. It's unclear how that would not apply to veterans with severe physical disabilities. Also, the legislative history also refers to, as opposing counsel noted, the concept of in-home medical care, which by its definition is, according to the statute, is a higher level of care. It also refers to and distinguishes between the needs for veterans with traumatic brain injury to receive for management and supervision, as well as aid and attendance. So there's a recognition that those type of services would be necessary. And not that, again, not this distinction that, as I think has been implied, that they're not for veterans with traumatic brain injury. Like, that higher level of care was acknowledged. Now, may it be different in specific nature? Probably, but even the facts here show that the manifestations of traumatic brain injury can be similar to those with to veterans with a severe physical injury. Mr. Haskell suffered balance problems from which he could fall. He had memory problems, which created dangers in the kitchen with potential for fire, for the use of appliances. So I think it is to the record and the legislative history and frankly, the history of the Secretary's development of the regulations, which acknowledge explicitly the cognitive impairments to include the need for aid and attendance, as well as emotional behavioral impairments, as well as physical, all indicate that those considerations and those distinctions were known and acknowledged, and the Secretary was attempting to implement that knowledge within the administration of disability benefits. So, again, we disagree that there was this clear distinction on the nature of the care that is involved.
Thank you, Mr. Carey. Or did you want to sum up for a sentence?
I was waiting. Yes.
Okay.
If, So for the foregoing reasons, the court should find that the board relied on a lawful regulation in determining that Mr. Haskell was not entitled to additional compensation based on a higher level of care. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Odom?
We all agree higher level of care doesn't appear in subsection T. Secretary may disagree with Congress's policy decision to provide veterans with severe residuals of TBI with the same level of compensation as veterans with severe physical disabilities. But it's not the Secretary's duty to second-guess Congress's policy. In Sharp versus United States, which we cited in our briefs, Federal Circuit made clear the outcome might not be exactly make sense to some people, but you cannot second-guess Congress's policy decisions. Here, though, we have the benefit of the legislative history, and we know why Congress made this policy decision. It was to prioritize veterans with traumatic brain injury. This court should further Congress's policy decision by striking down the portion of 3.352 that requires more than what's required by subsection T. There are no further questions. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Otto. And the court thanks both parties for the arguments. The case is submitted for consideration, and court is adjourned. We will come down and greet counsel. And everyone, please stay in your seats because we will have a Q&A beginning momentarily.
All rise. Court is in recess.